This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. A symphony is a work of fiction in music. Themes and musical gestures are a symphony's characters. The plot consists of the changes those themes and gestures go through during the course of the piece, and the chapters are the individual movements. Johannes Brahms' symphonies are dramas that tell stories of love, loss, redemption, and reconciliation. Big themes, the things that great art deals with. Brahms' life would make a great story in itself. Growing up in poverty, spending his adolescence playing piano in dives and brothels near the Hamburg docks, he still managed to receive a solid musical education and was touring as a virtuoso pianist by the time he was 20. But he spent his career burdened by great expectations. First, those placed on him by his mentor, Robert Schumann, who proclaimed him no less than the savior of music. And later on, those he placed on himself, feeling the ghost of Beethoven looking over his shoulder every time he tried to write a symphony. Brahms had also become the standard bearer for absolute music, telling stories through the notes themselves without the benefit of external sources or added words. This put him on one side of the great artistic debate of the 19th century. Brahms and absolute music, building on the traditions of Haydn, Mozart, and Beethoven, versus Liszt and Wagner, with their tone poems and music dramas pointing the way, or so they said rather loudly, to the future. As a classicist, Brahms was limited by form, but at the same time, he was liberated by it. Structural demands can lead to expressive discoveries. And in the same way that the restrictions of the sonnet forced Shakespeare, Milton, and Keats deeper into the wells of their imaginations, Brahms found a way to concentrate deep romantic sincerity into classical structures. In forcing him to be concise and direct, structure stimulated Brahms. Brahms was well aware that in order to claim a place in the tradition of great composers, he would have to write a symphony. He was also well aware that most of his predecessors in that tradition had begun writing symphonies in their 20s, or even earlier. His official excuse was that he was intimidated by the ghost of Beethoven. "You have no idea what it's like to hear the footsteps of a giant like that behind you," is the classic quote. But Brahms was also a perfectionist. He was his own harshest critic, destroying most of his sketches to leave behind only the finished product, so no one would ever know what he had gone through to create his masterpieces. He had actually begun writing a symphony while in his early 20s, right on schedule, but he wasn't satisfied, and the material eventually became his first piano concerto. Over the next 2 decades, 2 serenades, the German Requiem, and his variations on a theme by Haydn all helped him find his own symphonic voice, learning how to create and arrange sonic shapes. By the time he reached his mid-40s, he'd established himself as Europe's leading composer of abstract absolute music, and he was ready to confront the musical ghosts that had been haunting him. Brahms announces his arrival as a symphonist with huge dissonant chords sounded by the full orchestra over pounding timpani. He's making sure we know that this is serious business, something that demands our attention. But at the same time, it's something we can identify with, something that gives voice to what we ourselves have felt in the same way that great literature articulates what we have sensed but not yet said. Now that he has us, Brahms lets the turbulence subside for a moment with plucked strings taking over the heartbeat from the timpani. The fury ebbs and flows until finally the oboe introduces a phrase that passes to the other winds and the low strings. Things get quieter and quieter until they are almost inaudible, creating an atmosphere that is almost ominous, until, for a moment, all forward motion stops. Like a marksman with a cocked rifle, Brahms squeezes the trigger and the movement explodes into some of the most violent music he would ever write. Colliding, meshing, tearing apart, occasionally spelled by moments of lyricism, but always returning to the conflict. In the midst of all this, announced by blazing fanfares, comes the contrast of a huge chorale. It's a brief glimpse of the triumph that will conclude the symphony. A series of staccato outbursts. Builds the tension until suddenly, all energy spent, the pulsing timpani ushers in the coda, at first wistful, then foreboding, finally serene. But where will the story go from here? The second movement is marked andante, a walking tempo. It opens in the calm mood that concluded the first movement, but without its edge of apprehension. The oboe enters with a sweet melody that will develop into the heart of the movement. The conflict returns in a passage for the strings, the solo violin enters as a calming presence, singing the melody that the oboe introduced earlier. The violin is joined by the horn, and the movement ends in calm and simplicity. The third movement opens with an innocent dance tune that is followed by two contrasting sections. One, a manic variation of the innocent dance. The other broader and nobler, with a touch of German folk song about it. The two tunes alternate, and the movement ends with a pizzicato, plucked section in the strings that suggests that something big is about to happen. Then, with almost no pause, the finale begins. A great gathering crush of sound that pulls us back to the world of the first movement, with a reminder that the conflicts of the opening may have been put aside for a while, but they have not been solved. The pizzicato strings from the end of the first movement build to a frenzy and then are cut off by a timpani roll. Suddenly, the clouds part and a horn calls from the top of the mountain, opening a brass chorale. This is the introduction to the big tune. This is the tune that caused Edvard Hanslick, the influential and often caustic critic, to dub the symphony Beethoven's Tenth. When he first pointed out this resemblance to the Ode to Joy, Brahms supposedly replied, "Any ass can see that." Hanslick's remark may have been meant as a put-down, but it affirmed the work's status as the most important symphony since Beethoven's Ninth. As in the first movement, the struggles of the finale are huge, epic. But earlier, the action was set in a locked room, the interior space of a mind turned into a prison cell by its obsession with a single idea. Here, the story plays out on an open playing field, and we feel like we're headed somewhere. But just what that destination may be isn't clear until the last moments. Brahms dives into the coda, at first ominous, then increasingly wild, and finally the breakthrough, the consummation of everything that has led to this point. The orchestra opens, and with one voice repeats the chorale that the trombones had stated with such dignity earlier in the movement. Brahms draws out the coda with a series of flourishes, partly as a nod to Beethoven's extended endings, but also as if he doesn't want to let it go. So much time and effort, so many false starts, so long in the making, and so triumphant in its resolution. For many of us, one of the great pleasures in life is curling up with a good book, immersing yourself in it, and letting your imagination carry you away. At a time when many composers were translating words into the language of music, Brahms chose to create his own musical characters, using precise musical forms and structures to carry the story, and leaving it to his listeners to interpret the characters and be carried away, wordless, by their own imaginations. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.